As if he were intuitively aware that what he was doing was immoral, if not illegal, Todd would not permit his quail-hunting friends to participate in his first syndicates. But when they heard of the considerable profits being made in such deals, they wanted in. Now, when he had a firm grasp of the intricacies, he told them on a ride south to their lease. "All right, you clowns, you wanted to share in the action. I have a lead on a swell chunk of property north of FM 1960, but well south of Route 2920, place near Tomball, 200 choice acres, about 10,000 an acre." "Hey," the oil man said, "that's $2 million. "But we don't put it up. Most we have to contribute, maybe 10,000 each. The rest, a mortgage, long payout, whatever interest the seller demands. Because the rate of growth on this property is going to be sensational. Let time take care of the mortgage and the interest." They were approaching Victoria when he made this proposal, and Roy Bubb, who was driving as usual, slowed down and stared at him. "You sneaky sumbitch. When you bought my place, you didn't have a nickel to your name, did you? All hokey-pokey and fancy dance steps. Did you lose a penny on the deal, cowboy?" "No, and I've been trying to figure out who did." "Nobody, that's who. We were playing the Texas game, all of us, and that time it worked. It can work this time, too." His final talk with Gabe Klinowitz had scared him, and he had vowed that on this deal with his three friends he would play it completely honest. They would share totally in any growth this land achieved. And if there was a sale, it would be at arm's length to some complete stranger, with all the papers visible to the partners. He was so determined to avoid the traps that Gabe had warned about that he even called on Gabe in the latter's grubby office. "You scared me, Gabe. I can see what you were warning me about. Been brooding over it. Three of my close friends and I are organizing this syndicate for some choice land up by Tomball. I want you to come in, open books and a final sale to some third party. Clean." But Gabe said, "I never double back." And when the time came to liquidate the Quail Hunters Syndicate, as they termed it, Todd could not resist putting together a secret syndicate in which he had an unannounced share, and of which he would be the Sub Rosa general partner. And he sold the Tomball acreage to this syndicate for about half its real value. In addition to his share of the Quail Hunters' profit, he took a 10% brokerage fee for handling the sale and a huge percentage of the new syndicate. Todd Morrison was now a multimillionaire. When Maggie Morrison made out the family's income tax, she discovered that in liquidating the Quail Hunters Syndicate, her husband had inadvertently failed to distribute to his three hunting partners profits to which they were legally entitled, and she drew his attention to this oversight. Todd, not wishing to reveal that his retention of those profits had been far from accidental, said with ill-feigned astonishment, "Maggie, you're right. There's $48,000 they should split among them." And she replied, "At least." So, on the next drive down to Falforius, he told the men, as if bringing good news which he had uncovered, "Hey, you junior J.P. Morgans, final figures on our syndicate show that we have an unexpected $48,000 to split up." But when the cheering stopped, and time came to tell them it would be split three ways, for it was their money, he found himself saying, "So that means an extra $12,000 for each of us. Come Monday, we can all buy new Cadillacs." When the Cobbs settled into their home north of Levelland, Sherwood started immediately to make his gin the premier one in the area, and he began in the traditional way. He became a vociferous supporter of the Levelland Lobos, who consistently seemed to wind up their seasons 3-7, if they got the breaks. The countryside appreciated his enthusiasm and entered the judgment that this here Cobb is dependable. From this solid foundation he could build. At the end of the third year, Sherwood gathered Nancy and their children in the kitchen and spread the figures before them. At Lammermoor, 119 pounds of lint to the acre, bringing 9 cents a pound. In Waxahachie, 239 pounds at 28 cents a pound. Here in Levelland, £391 at 42 cents a pound. Year's profit from cotton, gin, and other operations, $149,000. In view of these figures, he advised his family not to complain about the disadvantages of living atop the Caprock. This is the cotton capital of the world, and no gin in the United States processed more of it last year than we did. I'm putting every cent we earned into more land and more wells. This can go on forever. It was a sultry afternoon in May when Ransom Rusk and Mr. Kramer were on Rusk's patio discussing the latter's work in providing armadillos for the leprosy research in Louisiana. It was going well, Kramer said, and new discoveries were being made every month, it seemed, toward an ultimate cure for Hansen's disease. They don't like to call it leprosy anymore. The Bible gave what's an ordinary disease a bad name. To the surprise of the two experts, Lady Macbeth and her eight witches were moving about long before sunset. And this was so unusual that Rusk commented on it, and Kramer said, "Something's afoot." And they watched the little insect-eaters for some minutes as they darted here and there, their armor reflecting in the sun. Then, suddenly, the mother began rounding up the four youngest pups and nudging them towards their burrow in the middle of the former bowling lawn. And as she herself headed for the hole, the four older pups galloped across the lawn and beat her to the entrance. "They must know something," Kramer said. And before he could begin to speculate on what it was, a maid came onto the patio. "Radio says tornado watch," and Kramer dashed inside. Telephoning a friend who helped him maintain a close guard on the weather, he spoke only a few words, then ran back to Rusk. "Not a watch, a real warning. Tornado touched down at the southern end of Tornado Alley." The words were ominous. "I must get to my anemometers," Kramer cried, running toward his car. "Stay here," Rusk bellowed. And so imperative was his voice that the expert on weather obeyed. From a vantage point on the second floor of the mansion, they studied the southwestern sky, supposing that the tornado, if it sustained its forward motion, would move north along its customary corridor. And they had been in position only briefly when they saw a sight that meant horror to anyone who had ever experienced a tornado. As if some giant scene shifter were rearranging the sky, the desultory clouds which had been filtering the heat were moved aside, their place taken by a massive black formation. "It's a real one," Kramer said quietly. He started below, seeking some sturdy archway under which to hide, but Rusk grabbed his arm. "We have a cellar." So for some minutes the two stayed aloft to watch the frightening cloud. It came directly at Larkin on its way to Wichita Falls, and Kramer spotted the twister first, a terrible, brutal finger reaching down, a black funnel twisting and turning and tearing apart anything unlucky enough to lie within its path. It was going to hit, and hard. "One of the big ones," Kramer said. But still Rusk held fast, mesmerized by the awesome power of that churning finger as it uprooted trees, tossed automobiles in the air, and disintegrated houses. His final view, before Kramer dragged him to the first floor, was of the upper cloud moving much faster than the lower spout, with the latter trailing behind and trying to catch up, destroying everything in its way as it did so. Rusk showed remarkable control, checking rooms as he ran. "Everybody to the cellar." On the ground floor, he led the way to the heavy door that opened upon a flight of steel stairs, at the bottom of which waited a small, dark room, lined with bottles of water, dehydrated foods, medical supplies, and blankets. With that door closed, the household members were as safe as anyone could be with the needle of a tornado passing overhead. Wall shook, window shattered as suction pulled them outward from their frames. Walls shook. Windows shattered as suction pulled them outward from their frames. A roar like that of a train passing echoed through the heavy door, and even this strongly built house trembled as if made of the frailest adobe. For one sickening moment, it seemed as if the rooms above were being torn apart, and a Mexican maid began to sob quietly, but Rusk reassured her in an effective way. "Magdalena, when the storm ends, the people out there will need your help." And he issued directions. As soon as I open the door, fan out and collect the wounded. If you find any dead bodies, put them on the lawn out front. When Rusk gingerly opened the door, the servants scrambled up the steel stairway to view the desolation. No windows were left along the south and west faces of the mansion. Large chunks of the roof had been torn away. In the garden, trees had been uprooted, and to demonstrate the grotesque power of the storm, a small bungalow had been carried 200 feet through the air and deposited upside down in the middle of the bowling lawn, its structure intact. After a brief survey, the servants began to search the streets and alleys, and the tragic task of finding bodies in the rubble began. Some were miraculously pulled free minutes before they would have suffocated. Others would not be found for 2 days. Mr. Kramer saved 4 men by piping oxygen to them through metal tubes, which he forced through debris that could not at the moment be moved. One woman was distraught, for her 5-year-old son had been torn from her arms and sucked high into the air, to be thrown down she could not guess where. Frantically, she searched for him through the mass of damaged buildings, and she was trying to tear boards away to look for him when a neighbor found him 400 yards away, unscathed. 14 people died in Larkin, 10 of them in automobiles, a heavy toll for such a small town. "Remember, damn it," Mr. Kramer muttered, as men helped him pull a body out of one of the crushed cars. "Worst place to hide in a tornado, your car. Wind must have lifted this one 300 feet in the air and smashed it down. We'll need torches to get him out." The dead man inside was Dewey Kimbrough. For 70 years he had roamed Texas looking for carboniferous signals. 4 times his discoveries had made him a millionaire. 4 times he had allowed the money to slip away. His will distributing his final fortune displayed his customary gallantry, for it awarded $200,000 each to the 5 women with whom he had been entangled, and that included the girl Esther, whom he had brought to Larkin with him that first time but had never married. When the citizens heard of his generosity to the women who had given him so much trouble, they forgot how they had censured him and said at his funeral, "Good old Dewey, he was a character." Of course, when his will was probated, the court found that it had less than $3,000 to distribute, all the wealth Dewey had accumulated in those last wonderful years in the Permian Basin had been dissipated. The tombstone, which Ransom Rusk erected, said, "A real Texas wildcatter." Task Force. For the past 28 years, Lorenzo Quimper had participated in the Texas Olympics, that is, man versus mesquite, and the score stood Mesquite 126, Quimper 5, which was better than many Texans did. Whenever Lorenzo had acquired a new ranch, he started the same way, as if following the score of a ritual ballet. "Candido, we've got to clear these fields of mesquite." In 1969, he had tackled his first field. "Candido, we'll chop it down." He and his Mexican workforce did just that, using power saws instead of axes, and they did a respectable job. Meadows completely clean. But since the pesky mesquite had 1 very deep taproot, plus innumerable laterals for every branch that showed above, this laborious cutting was nothing more than a helpful pruning. Nearly 2 years later, "Good God, Candido, there's more out there than when we started." So in 1970, he and his workers burned off the mesquite. But this was a dreadful mistake, because the ashes served as a perfect fertilizer for the roots. 1 year later, the fields were positively luxuriant, not with grass, but with new mesquite. In 1972, following the advice of experts at A&M, he once more cut down the trees and then used acid on the visible roots. And this did kill them, definitely. But his acid reached only some 6% of the roots, whereupon the survivors leaped into action to take up the slack. "You'd think there were devils down there prodding them to spring up through the soil," he groaned one day. And Candido said, "You may have something there, boss." In 1974, a new group of experts, including men from the Great King Ranch in South Texas, who had fought mesquite for 50 years, visited the Quimper ranches to demonstrate a new technique. What we do, Lorenzo, is cut the tree off at the base of the trunk, then use these two huge tractors to drag a chain which cuts deep beneath the soil. We don't just pull up the main roots, we root prune the entire plant, get all the little trailers. For 3 years, the Quimper ranches looked fairly good, with a minimum of mesquite. But by 1977, the savage trees were back in redoubled force. They've been sleeping, Mr. Quimper, just conserving their strength. They had a lot of it when they reappeared, so that in 1978, Lorenzo said, "To hell with it." And his costly fields grew a little grass for his cattle, a lot of mesquite in which his quail, his deer, and his wild turkeys could hide. Of course, Il Magnifico did not lose completely, as the score indicated. He did win 5 times, but only because he poured into selected fields a modest fortune in dynamite, tractors, chains, acid, and muscle. He calculated that for a mere $6,000 an acre, any man could effectively drive mesquite off land which had cost $320 an acre to begin with. His victories were pyrrhic, but he did have a limited revenge. Since our June meeting was to be held in the nearby German community of Fredericksburg, Quimper invited us to spend the preceding evening at what he called my home ranch on Lake Travis, west of Austin. When we entered his living room, we saw that he had finally triumphed over his mesquite. He had directed Candido to cut down 200 of their biggest mesquites, most of them not over 10 feet tall or 8 inches across, and from the cores of these trunks his men had cut a wealth of squares, 3 inches on the side, half an inch thick. Using them as parquetry, he had fitted them into a heavy cement base, and then burnished the surface with heavy buffers usually reserved for marble. When the floor was leveled and smoothed, and after a thin silicone paste had been applied and polished to a gleaming finish, the result was a most handsome floor. The jagged patterns of the mesquite thus laid bare formed an intricate work of art, predominantly purple, but with red, green, yellow, and brown flecks or scars. "It's a floor of jewels," said one delighted visitor. And it was, the neat squares of wood showing 1,000 different patterns, 100 variations in color. Lorenzo had triumphed, but it had not been easy. "Come out here to the workshed. Look at that pile of burned-out saw blades. Cutting that floor was hell." He looked at the stack of blades, nearly 3 feet high, and said, "Of course, doing the library was even worse. The blocks were smaller." Our session the next day was memorable, for it consisted of 3 unique stages. When we convened for breakfast in Fredericksburg, one of the finest small towns of Texas, with an immensely wide main street, good German restaurants, European music, and citizens eager to make visitors welcome, we were met by representatives of 6 of the state's minorities. Germans, Czechs, Italians, Poles, Scots, and Wends. And we could have talked with 20 other such groups had we had the time, for Texas is truly a state built from minorities. When the speaking ended, the groups brought in dance teams in native costume and regional orchestras playing unfamiliar instruments. And as we applauded, older people served ethnic dishes of wondrous complexity. This was a Texas which not many outsiders imagined, and among the scores who entertained us, there was not an oil man or a cowboy. After lunch, we drove 14 miles east to adjacent rural parks, one national, one state, honoring Lyndon Baines Johnson. At the heart of the parks, overlooking the Pedernales, stood an unpretentious one-room house which had been converted into a recreation center. Here we held our afternoon session, at which 3 scholars from New York and Boston addressed us on the significance of Johnson's occupancy of the White House. As we met there in a meeting to which the public had been invited, we could see the hill country that LBJ had loved. We could feel his tall, gangling presence, a sensation that was enhanced when Lady Bird herself came unannounced to invite us to refreshments at her ranch across the river. Texas history seemed very real that day. When we ended our meeting at 6:30, we were handed another surprise by Il Magnifico. "The missus and me are throwing a little do back at our ranch in favor of our daughter, Sudine, her 16th birthday, and we want you all to come. Spend the night." So we piled into the limousines which Rusk and Miss Cobb provided for the occasion and drove the 40-odd miles back to the Quimper Ranch. As we saw that splendid rolling country of scattered oak, mesquite, and wisache, Ephraim said to Miss Cobb, "I imagine a newcomer from the wooded hills of New Hampshire or from the real mountains of Montana would find this rather ordinary. But when you've worked all day in steaming Houston and fly up here in your own plane on Friday night, this must seem like heaven." "It is," she said. As we approached Lake Travis, which came into being in 1934 when the Colorado River was dammed, I commented on the incredible good luck that seemed to crown any Quimper real estate venture. "Do you have a crystal ball?" And he replied apologetically in country style, "I swear to you on a stack of Bibles, my pappy was just riding along here one sunny day in 1930 and said to himself, 'Someday they'll build a dam here and make themselves a lake.' So he bought 7,000 acres at $63 each, and now it's worth 6,000 an acre, five times that much if it fronts the lake." "How was he clever enough to foresee that?" I asked. And Lorenzo said, "He had no privileged warning, just believed that whenever you grab onto Texas land, something good is likely to happen." At the entrance to his ranch, a massive stone gateway had been erected in a style borrowed from ancient Assyria. Monstrous blocks of granite piled helter-skelter, but with dramatic effect. As we passed through these stones, uniformed police, hired for the evening, directed us to an assembly area, 10 or 15 acres kept cleared by a flock of sheep, where several hundred people awaited instructions. After our cars were unloaded, a whistle blew, policemen waved, and a make-believe train of 9 cars, dragged by a tractor locomotive, pulled up to carry us to wherever the girls' birthday party was to be held. The train took us along a country lane, through a stand of oak trees, and onto another empty field. Traversing this at slow speed, it brought us into an area which caused us to gasp. To prove to his daughter that he loved her, Quimper had hired a complete circus. There stood the Ferris wheel, the 2 merry-go-rounds, the bumper car enclosure, the crazy quilt palace of delights with its distorting mirrors, the markers luring people into the free sideshows, and the line of cages with lions, tigers, and bears. 6 clowns did impossible things, and the high-wire act was enthralling. At the height of the show, the lead clown came roaring across the field in a Mercedes 450 SL, vanity license plates Q. Sue, which he presented to the Quimper girl as her birthday present. Miss Cobb whispered, "Doesn't every lassie get a Mercedes?" But my attention was diverted to a scene that was taking place between Quimper and his wife. I heard him tell her, "Honey, we're in trouble. We're running out of food." "Impossible," she said. "I baked the cookies myself, thousands of them, and we have more than enough barbecue." "That's not the problem. About 100 of our neighbors have seen the lights, and they've come over to join in the fun." It was a warm-hearted party, and by Texas rich standards, not preposterous or even ostentatious. The Quimpers had the ranch, they had the money, and they enjoyed entertaining their neighbors. Above all, they wanted to be sure their daughter and her friends met the right kind of young people against the day when they must choose their marriage partners. For as Mrs. Quimper said, if they don't meet people from the right schools and the right families, they might marry just anybody. We were sitting in Quimper's living room and congratulating ourselves on one of the best days our task force had spent when the whole facade collapsed. For Mrs. Quimper brought into the room one of the men who had addressed us that afternoon, a Professor Steer from Harvard, 48 years old, suave and sure of himself in his gray-touched hair, bow tie, and London tailoring. "What a coincidence," he said, as he reached for a drink and settled down. "My son, who's doing graduate work at SMU, is one of the young men out there dancing with the young ladies, especially a Miss Grady, and he dragged me along. I never dreamed you were the people I'd been addressing this afternoon." "We're mighty glad to have you," Quimper said, bringing him a plate of barbecue. The conversation started well, with Steer asking our 2 older men, "In Texas, are you considered oil men or ranchers?" to which Quimper replied, "In this state, a man can have 30 oil wells and a little old nothing ranch with 1,000 acres and 6 steers, but he calls himself a rancher." Rusk, trying to be amiable, said, "I have many friends who never wear a cowboy Stetson in Texas, but always when they go to New York or Boston." Miss Cobb said, "You'll find, Professor Steer, the Texas ranchers like to brag about their prize bull, the pilot of their airplane, and their unmarried daughter, in that order." Tricked by the apparent warmth of this greeting, Steer said, "I'm so glad to find you here. I sort of held back on certain fundamentals this afternoon. Too many of the public listening." "Like what?" Quimper asked. And the professor startled me by the frankness with which he responded. "I should have pointed out that Lyndon Johnson suffered bad luck in ascending to the presidency in the way he did." "How so?" Quimper probed. "Well, John Kennedy, for whom I worked, was a charismatic type, handsome, well-groomed, educated, able in leadership, and gifted with a beautiful, sophisticated wife." As this was said, I happened to be looking at Rusk, a Republican leader who had contributed to Johnson's campaigns but voted against him. He was studying his knuckles, not looking up, so I could not ascertain how he might be receiving this attack upon a fellow Texan. Steer continued, "A regrettable aspect of Johnson's ascendancy was that he came, in our interpretation..." Here I noticed that Steer had subtly changed from referring, as he had in his speech, to the Eastern establishment as them, and was now including himself in the ruling group. "We saw Vice President Johnson as a prototypical citizen of Dallas, the city which had killed the real president." Miss Cobb interrupted, "Dallas didn't kill anybody. A crazy drifter from New Orleans and Moscow did. But the nation perceived it as a Dallas crime, and I must admit, so did I." "Why?" Miss Cobb asked. "I was working for President Kennedy in those delicate days, 21 years ago this week. I'd accompanied Edley Stevenson to Dallas when the women leaders of your society spat upon him." "It was not my society," Miss Cobb protested. "They were right-wing extremists. You find them everywhere. But especially in Dallas." Since no one could reasonably contest this, Steer plunged ahead. "I was in the advance party that bleak November day in 1963 when Kennedy made his fatal visit. I was not near him, far off to the side when the motorcade came swinging into Dealey Plaza. But at breakfast I had presented him with the Dallas Morning News and its dreadful, irrational attack. You know what the last words he said to me were? 'We're heading into nut country today.' And a short time later, he was dead. In my interpretation, and it remains very firm this November, Dallas killed him." There was, with Texans like the five of us, a residual shame for what had happened back in 1963, and we were sophisticated enough to realize that some of what Professor Steer was so arrogantly reconstructing was true. The climate of Texas at that time, especially in Dallas, had been antithetical to much of what Kennedy as president stood for, even though the state had voted for him in 1960, and even though our own son, LBJ, had been instrumental in squeaking him into the White House by the slimmest margin ever. We were not disposed to argue vehemently in defense of Dallas. But now Steer, obviously pleased with the progress he was making in hacking Texas down to size, continued his impetuous drive. What happened was that Johnson came to impersonate the worst of Texas, as opposed to the best of New England. Texas was anti-labor. We were pro. Texas was fundamentalist in religion. We were enlightened. Texas was deficient in education. We stressed it. Texas was uncouth, the voice of the barbarian. New England was gently trained, the voice of academe. Texas was cowboys and oil. The North was libraries and theater and symphony orchestras. Texas was the raw frontier. Boston was the long-established bulwark of inherited values. And what was especially difficult for us to accept, Texas was flamboyant nouveau riche, and the Northeast had long since disciplined such ostentation. I saw that Quimper was about to explode, but what Steer said next delayed the fuse. I grant you that in those days Texas had energy and wealth and sometimes valuable imagination, but it was not a likable place, and few in the establishment liked it. For the first time, Rusk spoke, deep in his chest. How exactly do you define the establishment? This was the kind of question Steer liked, for it provided an excuse to parade his skill at summarization. I suppose I mean the opinion makers, the agencies that give us our mindsets. Two newspapers, New York Times and Washington Post. Three magazines, Time, Newsweek, The London Economist. The three networks, and one special publication, The Wall Street Journal, plus the faculties of the better universities and colleges. And what are those better schools? Rusk asked, as if he were ignorant. And Steer obliged. Yale, Harvard, Princeton, and maybe Chicago. Brown, yes, and maybe Dartmouth. A few of the smaller colleges like Amherst and Williams. A smattering of the old girls' schools, Vassar, Smith, perhaps Bryn Mawr. They're the ones who passed judgment on Lyndon Johnson? Rusk asked. We found him quite unacceptable. Again, I watched Rusk carefully, and he said no more, just kept studying his knuckles, which were now white. He was not under pressure, but he was listening intently. Steer, unaware of how close he was to a live volcano, proceeded with what was for him a fascinating bit of social phenomena. I think Texas is destined to play Rome to our Greece. What do you mean? Quimper asked, and Steer responded, when Greece lost world leadership to Rome, she fell back to the perfectly honorable role of providing Rome with intellectual leadership. Art, history, philosophy, logic, world view. Rome had none of these, could create none from her own resources. But she could borrow from Greece, import Greek tutors, Greek managers, and the symbiosis proved a fruitful one. What's symbiosis mean? Quimper asked naively, even though I'd heard him use the word at our last meeting. Interlocking relationship. Each part depends on the other. Could the Texas-Massachusetts symbiosis be fruitful? Quimper asked. And Steer said he thought that perhaps it could. You'll continue to inherit our representation in Congress, and you'll provide the money, the energy, and yes, the vitality, I suppose, all very necessary if an organism is to survive. What will you give us in return? Lorenzo asked sweetly. And Steer said, the intellectual analysis, the philosophical guidance, the historical memory. Believe me, a raw state like Texas will not be able to go it alone. Rome couldn't. Will Texas ever be accepted, by your eastern establishment, I mean? Quimper asked. Oh, when time softens your raw edges, when the television show Dallas slinks off the tube, if it ever does, when your petroleum reserves deplete, and you can no longer terrorize us with your oil money. Up to this point, neither Rusk nor Quimper showed any inclination to dispute our visitor's analysis. But Steer stumbled ahead and triggered a bear trap. The real test will be whether any of your colleges or universities can become first class. If they do, maybe the rest of America will be able to tolerate your extravagances. Now came an ominous pause, during which I looked at Professor Garza, who was smiling quietly and shrugging his shoulders as if to ask me, why should we two sane people get mixed up in this? So I was not watching when Rusk rose from his chair and straightened his drooping shoulders to their full height. But I did turn quickly when I heard him say in his deep, rumbling voice, get out of here. When Steer mumbled, what? What? Rusk lost control and fairly bellowed, get the hell out of here. And I saw with horror that he was trying to grab our visitor by the neck. You can't do this, I cried, interposing myself between the two men. But then Quimper lunged forward, as if he too wanted to throw the Harvard man out, and I looked to Miss Cobb for help. But to my dismay, she was encouraging the men. Before either Rusk or Quimper could reach Steer, I engineered our tactless visitor out the door and put him on the path to where his son would be. When I returned, I looked in dismay at my associates, but they showed no remorse. They had been mortally offended by the establishment's renewal of its assault on the dignity of Texas, and had absorbed all the abuse they could tolerate. They were pleased at having ejected him. "Why did you become so enraged?" I asked. And Rusk said, "When a Yankee denigrates LBJ, he denigrates Texas, and when he insults Texas, he insults me." "You never supported Johnson," I said, and he agreed, voted against him every time he ran. "But he was a Texan, and I cannot abide—" I broke in to ask Quimper if he'd ever voted for Johnson, and he said, "I've voted in various ways at various times." At this point, Mrs. Quimper appeared with a plate of fresh barbecue, and I was privileged to witness Quimper's face-saving victory in his war with Mesquite. When Garza asked, "How do you make your barbecue so delicious?" Lorenzo took him by the arm. "I'll show you." And he led us to a huge woodpile back of the house, where rows of mesquite logs, 21 inches long, lay stacked. On each of my ranches, I have crews doing nothing but harvesting mesquite. We grow it now as a cash crop. "What for?" Garza asked. And Quimper said, "We ship it to top-flight restaurants all over America. 21 in New York, the Plaza, that type. Everyone with money to spare orders Texas-style beef." He kicked at the pile affectionately. "I'm known as the Mesquite King of Texas. I'm making more on mesquite than I am on my boots. Like I always said, don't ever think Texas is licked till the fat lady sings." Then he stared at us and snapped his fingers. "Tomorrow morning, I'm stopping all shipments to Boston. Those Ivy Leaguers don't deserve mesquite."